Hey, 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 God's good people. This is your girl, CL Subs, with Mental and Love Notes 101. I pray you all are doing well. I hope you all are still sharing with family and friends and co-workers as well with the podcast, because you don't want to miss out on any good information. Today, I have a special guest with me. She is no stranger to me. I've known her for a while. When I first met her, she was participating in a community event with her church family, the infamous Bishop Rosie O'Neill and the Cornelia family. At the event, she told me a little bit about herself, and I listened. But one thing she said that had my light bulb go off is when she told me she was what I was aspiring to be. She told me she worked in the school system as a licensed counselor. At that time, I was a student in grad school, and I knew it would soon come to me doing my practicum and internship, so she was willing to take me under her wings and assist my counseling journey. Having a cadre of professionals was what I needed, even in my own issues. Most of that you can read about in my book, Abused, Afflicted, and Confused, But Now Delivered, is how I became to be what I once needed. As she and I began to have dialogue, she begins to share a little bit about her story and how she came about to writing her first book. At this very moment, I want to introduce you all to Ms. Demetrius Cobb, licensed professional counselor, as the state has changed it now, so it's licensed mental health counselor. I'm going to introduce you all to Demetrius Cobb. Welcome, Ms. Demetrius.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, like you said, Demetrius Cobb. I am married to Anthony L. Cobb, and we live here in Winterville, North Carolina. I've worked as a school counselor for the last 15 years, a licensed professional counselor since 2013, and also I do supervision as a counselor. A little bit more about myself. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I have my husband's sons, 26, 25, and 23, and just enjoying life. I am a member of Koinonia. I'm a zone leader. I enjoy that very much, and I love to write, and I love to collaborate with other people and do events in the community. So I do a lot of volunteer here and there. I'm also a board member with Mediation Center of Eastern North Carolina, and have just started doing that, but I enjoy that a lot. And also a member of Black Creatives, which is an art group through Emerge. Trying to give back to the community in such a way that I won't sit back and complain about some of the racial climate and tensions, but see if I can make a difference by volunteering.
Yes, and Ms. Cobb also was one of our guest presenters on our monthly workshop. You can always go back to www.changerequireschange.org and get some of those resources that was on the website. As a mental health counselor, do you feel that this pandemic is causing anxiety levels to go up?
I do. I do believe that, anxiety levels have went up. Some people have experienced, all kinds of crisis during this time. And then being isolated has not helped. Even with some of the resources that have went out, from different places like food and some financial resources and things of that nature, it still doesn't take the place of having someone to talk to. So I do believe people have become a little anxious, and it's affected their mental health.
And you said mental health, and I know during the process of writing your first book, which is
it's called Repair of the Breach.
Mm-hmm. You had an encounter with someone who had some mental issues, and it was transcribed to bringing out that book. Can you tell us about that?
So in 1995, I was a law enforcement officer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and a man who was diagnosed with schizophrenia at the time, he was 26 years old, a law student at UNC. He had gotten off of his medication, and he wasn't seeking treatment at that time. he basically he self-isolated. He began to just stay to himself. I think he broke up with his girlfriend, stopped going around his family. And that isolation led to him becoming very unhealthy. Unhealthy to the point that he decided to get his grandfather's weapon. It was a high-powered rifle. And he walked up and down the streets of Chapel Hill shooting people at random. And unfortunately, as a law enforcement officer at that time, I did get caught in the crossfire of him shooting, just randomly shooting at people. I got shot at over 28 times. One of the bullets did land in my left hand. I lost part of my hand, a lot of shrapnel in my face, and a silhouette to the right of my body. But thankfully, no other bullet entered my body, and I was able to recover. But unfortunately, he did murder two people that day, and he also was able to, you know, shoot at a lot of other people and cause a lot of property damage.
So in the midst of, you know, responding to that call, did you expect that day?
Oh, no, not at all. I was actually, that day was a peculiar day anyway, because our lieutenant was off duty that day. We had someone stand in his stead, Lieutenant Cole, and we were assigned different parts of the city. And although I'm usually in a certain place of the city that day, I had court duty. So I went to court that day, and for the most part, when you're in court duty, you don't have to answer any calls, obviously. So I thought it was a pretty slow day in that way. And we were dealing with a case or a situation, and were released for lunch by the judge. The courthouse had closed for lunch. And so instead of taking my lunch, I actually just checked back in to give the other officers a break. So no, it was completely unexpected. I went to one call, it was a traffic call, and then as soon as I left that call, I was called to gunshots being fired in the area where this man was. And although I was the second officer on the scene, there was so much radio traffic and communication going across the radio that I couldn't get an exact location of where he was. And I went to the last place that was called across the radio, and that happened to be not quite where he was, but near where he was, except he was down in some bushes, and that's why I didn't see him. When he raised up to my car window, he was camouflaged. My car was passing him. I just basically pressed the gas as fast as I could. I never even really saw him except out of the corner of my eye when his weapon had already been released. I mean, he had already shot at me by this time.
You know, I know a lot of times people, and you're a Christian woman as yourself, as well as myself, and I know a lot of times people make the comment, well, you have to forgive and forget. I always have a problem with that, because I can forgive somebody, and yes, that forgiveness may take place, but at the same time, if you cut off my arm, I'm not going to forget the fact that you cut off my arm. And I know you said you lost part of your left hand. Can you tell us about more about helping the community, helping the people understand, even in this spiritual light that we are going in? You know, a lot of times people have had so much damage done to them, and they continue to keep forgiving the person. I know the Bible said forgiving, you know, 70 times 7, and we have to keep doing that. But how much do you allow a person to continue to stab you in your back or to hurt you harmfully before you realize this is toxic and I need to let it go?
I'll be honest with you, I never knew this man, so I didn't have a personal attachment to him.
Okay.
And honestly, for me, it was forgiveness. It was general forgiveness. It wasn't, it was a forgiveness I cannot really describe in the sense of thinking I was over it when I really wasn't. I went through a long time of just shame. I was just really ashamed of my hand, the way it looked, and just embarrassed about, you know, what I had been through. And, you know, every time I would see him on the news, because it was worldwide news. So every time I would see something on the news about him, because the case was still going on even a year later, I would get really angry and frustrated. I didn't want to talk about it, didn't want to really hear about it, and it took me a while even to just go through the motions of discussing it, you know, through therapy and through even prayer and the church. But to be honest with you, it was a time where I believe the Lord was leading me to forgive. Generally, when I say generally, I mean I was really frustrated because I couldn't use my hand the way I wanted to. Go to pick up a basket and I could not fully grasp the, you know, anything, like, it's, you know, small. I had to put my whole arm around it because my hand just wasn't working right. But I was at my grandmother's house one day, and my grandmother was playing this music, Your Grace and Mercy Brought Me Through.
Oh, yes.
That helped me so much, that particular time. I went in the back room of my grandmother's house. Well, even before that, I was just crying and rocking myself and holding my hand and my arm, because I was like, Lord, you know, I actually lifted my hand up to my face the day that I got shot, as if my hand could block a bullet, and I know that's not the case. That bullet should have went probably through my head, to be honest with you. And the way the bullets even silhouetted around my body, something should have came through my back. But it was the grace and mercy of God,
yes,
I believe,
yes,
that did not allow, you know, me to be more damaged than what I was. And when I started thinking about that, and I started thinking about how, you know, God delivered me from that. It wasn't my head. Okay, it was my hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Something came over me where I didn't have to be ashamed of my hand anymore.
Yeah.
I was like, it was the grace and mercy of God that brought me through that situation. And I honestly, from that day of experiencing that whole, it was an emotional day, because that song, I was rocking myself, I was crying, my grandma was praying with me, and it was just a beautiful day. I had a piece of leather that I wore on my hand every day. By this time, it was pretty much kind of healed, and the skin grafts had, you know, healed up. I took that leather piece off because it was even darker than my skin, and it was probably, you know, bringing more attention to me than I even thought at that time. But I'm thinking I'm covering something up. But I took that off that day. I didn't wear that anymore. I just started doing things like massaging my hand. I wouldn't cover my hand up anymore. And if somebody asked, you know, was that a birth defect or something like that, I wasn't ashamed to tell them no, you know, and share my testimony.
Yes,
basically.
Yes.
So I use that to go all the way back to the forgiveness piece.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I didn't know Wendell Williamson directly, mm-hmm, which was his name. But I did go through a lot of shame and a lot of anger and frustration that was beyond the physical, where I had to generally just forgive him as a person,
right?
You know, for, you know, causing that trauma on so many people, because he affected so many people that day. Yeah, a woman lost her son. A son lost his dad just walking to the mailbox. And then the community was just shaking.
Yeah,
everybody was, you know, in awe. At that time, it was one of the only, you know, mass shootings that happened in North Carolina at that time. So, I mean, it was pretty traumatic, but I feel like I have no hatred towards that man today. I really don't. Of course, I know that, you know, mental health is a sickness, and you don't want people to be violent and cause their, take their mental health out on other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it is
become problematic for
everybody.
Right.
So it's something to behold with that. But to hold him in an unforgiveness, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. And I believe I have left it in God's hands to, you know, handle whatever his, you know, his demise is.
And I love the fact that you said that song, because songs does so much to us. And, you know, I tell people all the time, when you get in that place of destitute, or you get in that place of depression, or you get in that place of just, God, I don't know what's going on. You know, I can't figure this out. And it just amazes me how a song would just come and lighten the whole load. You know, I can remember times, even undergrad, and I would walk through the, you know, parking lot, and all of a sudden, you know, this, I was going through some issues. My dad, you know, and this is before my dad had died. I was going through some issues, and I just was over the campus just crying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, trying to be a big girl going down the campus, and it was cold, brutally cold that day. And one of the classmates called, she came, she said, "It's cold out here, ain't it, Carlisha?" I'm like, "Yeah." But I'm thinking, I'm just crying. I was tore up. But I remember listening to the chime, because my University of Mount Olive, at certain times, the chime, the bells will start ringing and sing. Mm-hmm. And my spirit man was singing the song, but my flesh was so distorted, it just wasn't paying attention. But when I lined up to understand what that song was singing, it was playing Amazing Grace. And you talking about somebody really crying, I was snotting all over the place. But I thank God, because that song helped me get through.
Yeah.
You know, and this let me know that, you know, God is right there with me. And, you know, the Bible said we overcome by testimony, because even when, you know, I have a scar in front of my chest, from the top of my chest all the way down to my stomach, from when I had double bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. And even times I can recall in my marriage, it almost destroyed me. That scar almost destroyed me, because I didn't want my husband to touch me. I didn't want him to see my body. I was so ashamed. You know, and not just that scar, all the other scars that went with it. But I was just so ashamed. I'm like, I don't want him to see my body. I don't want. But now I'm just, and the enemy played with my mind. He played with my mind to make me feel that you ugly. Nobody wants you. You know, look at you, you're deformed. And, but, you know, I tell him now, no, this is the best scar on this body. This black body, you hear me? I'm thankful. And you know, and even while we was talking, and because I didn't have a title for this interview. Mm-hmm. But even as we were talking, I heard God say, "Heal with scars." Mm. Heal with scars. Because I don't care how many scars you have on your body, God, when you know that God is right there with you,
yes.
He said, "Honey, let me tell you something. The scars that even Jesus proved that he still loved us."
Yeah.
That's a testimony right there. That's good.
Yes.
So my thing is, do you feel that the community is well-versed with mental health challenges?
You mean well-versed, meaning do they have the right supports in place?
The system, the resources, you know, and I know every county, every city is different, but right here in our area, do you think that there are more? Because, well, we believe it or not, you know, in these unprecedented times, so much is taking place, but me personally, I don't feel like there's a lot of resources out there for people who is committing suicide. I mean, just in June, one of our classmates from high school, son committed suicide because he couldn't handle the pressure of life anymore. So I just, and so that's why the Get Lit prayer call has been, you know, birthed out of me, just kind of just for the kids, because they go abundant so much, you know, not only just peer pressure, but if they don't have their phone, they feel like they done lost their world. If they don't have this, if they don't have money, and it's just so much. And to me, I just feel like the community is not really versed into helping the kids, especially.
I could agree with that. I mean, I know there are a lot of resources that are just not being tapped into, and people may not be seeking them out for whatever reason. They may not know about them for whatever reason. You know, just from my own personal experience of being a therapist, it's hard because you want your license. Your license is very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to put yourself out there when the community may not be able to either afford the resources or willing to afford the resources. Like, you can't, I mean, things just like everything else has progressed, and you know, people have evolved, so has mental health, and so has mental wellness, if you want to evolve with it. So sitting back waiting on insurance is fine. Mm-hmm. If that's what you have, that's fine. But the same way, you know, insurance works. You know, if you are willing to invest in your mental health, you should be willing to do that financially. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the cost of mental health, it costs the providers their license. Mm-hmm. If, you know, there's a lot of red tape with Medicaid and places like that where, you know, people have had to do a lot of legwork to get, you know, their documents in order for that. But, you know, there's private agencies that are willing to serve if people are willing to pay. And some people are just, you know, kind of like I say, you know, it's just been kind of the norm to depend on insurance. If you have it, that's fine. And then, you know, you seek out those providers through the insurance. But if you do not have insurance and you need mental health, and you do work, but you just don't have private insurance, you should be able to afford working with that provider. That provider will be, you know, willing to work with you maybe on a sliding scale or however you all come up with a good agreement. I've never had a referral that I would not take them because of finances. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to work with someone as long as they are open to the process. Okay. And that, I mean, I don't think you should, I know you, there's limits to everything, but I don't think you should put a dollar amount
when someone needs that help. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have talked about that in my book, you know, how there may be somebody that may not come to your chair, but are you willing to go to theirs? Mm-hmm. You know, because sometimes you just have to go into the community and help someone out. You know, I like what you were saying, that even in the time that you were describing, during the time of your trauma, you wasn't a therapist, but you received therapy. I know a lot of people say or put a stigma on needing therapy, especially the African American culture and especially Christian culture. I feel like therapy is so important, and it's nothing wrong with having prayer and appeal. I tell people all that, you know, have a prayer appeal. It helps you find that balance. Can you talk to us about, you know, just what it means to really get that therapy that you need, and, you know, and kind of steer away from the stigma type notions?
Well, what I like to do, because I personally had a problem with that myself, and it wasn't until I, you know, just became more enlightened that I understood, you know, how the process works or how some processes work. So the African American community does have legitimate reason not to trust the medical community. When you think about Henrietta Lacks, when you think about the Tuskegee Airmen, when you think about some of those stories, you know, African Americans do have legitimate reasons not to trust the medical community. So what I like to do, because I've been doing this for a long time, you know, from law enforcement and just working in human services for a long time, from law enforcement to group homes to private and to working in the public, is I would first get a baseline of what's going on and an individual assessment of that person. Sit down with them. Try to not just focus on a problem or one particular problem, but you do need, you know, a way to at least get a baseline of understanding so that the person you're working with and so that you as the therapist know where you start so you can grow. And then after you get the baseline, then you kind of go from there to see, you know, is progress being made, and you check in each time to see what progress is being made. And there are places in therapy where people get stagnant and they don't see any growth. People need to understand it's not for a quick fix, and it's not to fix you.
Yeah.
It's therapy is a place where you know, as a human being, from one human being to the other, I have a few guides that maybe you didn't get because of my, you know, education or because of my learning. I have a few tools that maybe you didn't get along the way.
Right.
So I'm going to share those tools with you. We're going to walk through this process together. I'm going to, you know, take your hand, or I'm going to let you lean on my shoulder, and we're going to walk through this process together in a therapeutic way. or, you know, an educated way because of the education that I've received, the information that I've received, the theories that I've learned, and, you know, some of the backdrops that I've gained. And then we're going to go from there. And, you know, the hope is always that after we get a baseline and after we see some growth, then we get some good outcomes.
And
basically that's it. I mean,
right, and I like that what you were saying because that's so empowering, a profound statement, and it reminds me of the Gestalt theory. You know, it's not about the parts of it, but healing the whole man. You know, dealing with the whole man, because I think a lot of times people bring this part to you, that part, and I just want you to deal with my parts, but can I deal with the whole man? Love you as a person first, you know, and then we move into the problem.
And we can address any crisis you might have experienced.
Yeah.
Definitely address those crises and see, you know, what ways we can prevent, you know, that crisis from happening again. But I'm not, you know, just there for your crisis. Because then what I find is people will, you know, what happens is you're looking for me to react or respond. Mm-hmm. And what I want to do is instead of just reacting, or just responding, mm-hmm. I want to make sure you got tools so that either we can prevent some stuff
not going there, on. You can still have coping strategies.
Right.
Yes. And you had mentioned earlier, trust is an issue, but I love that more of us, our culture is going out in the field, you know, making people a little bit more at ease, that it feel like a safe haven. You know, even myself, I'm a part of the Coalitions of Color, you know, social media group. And I love the fact that you see like-minded and kindred spirits, you know. So that I mean, I know you said even with yourself and as well as myself, I kind of was leery about, I don't know, therapists, I don't want nobody to think I'm cray-cray, you know what I'm saying, because that's the mentality we had. But even going into it myself, I couldn't afford no therapist. All that I endured, all that I went through, I couldn't afford no therapist. But I love how God orchestrated. You can't afford one, but I'm about to make you one. That you can help somebody else in that same situation, mm-hmm. that same issue, that same problem. Now you can help them with, like you said, with the tools that you regain. And so I was like, you know what, God? I love the fact that you made me something that I needed even when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And to be able to put me in a, like I said, in a room with full of, even when I did my internship, you know, with you and Dr. Lanier and you know, some more ladies, I'm just like, when I talk to y'all and sit down, I'm like, oh God, you brought me my help right here. That thing was good to me. I'm like, God, you brought me my help that I needed.
Yeah.
You know, and it reminds me of the scripture that said, in the presence of wise counsels, there is safety. You have to understand everybody you can't talk to.
That's right.
I can't tell everybody the raw parts of my heart.
Right.
You know, but when you can get into a place and sit there and like-minded people with the same, you know, going through the same issue or been through that issue, and you can talk to them, and they don't think, and they won't be judgmental. That bring comfort in knowing, let me just lay all of it on the table then, you know, so, but I'm thankful then. So how can one order your book for purchase about your courageous journey?
My books right now, I only have maybe 45 or so books left. So my books are off the market. Okay. This current book, Repair of the Breach, is actually off the market. My plans are to republish the book and put it back on the market with more information on mental wellness.
Okay.
So at this time, if someone wanted to purchase my book, they could contact me at my email, which is cobbserves@gmail.com, which is cobbserves@gmail.com.
Okay.
And let me know that they would like one of the books. And I would kindly mail it to them, and the price would be $12.
Okay.
Technically $10, but $2 I'll add to it for shipping.
Okay.
That's you know, for this book. And I'm actually planning on having the republishing, you know, no later than the end of 2022.
Okay. You want to share anything else with the listeners?
I was looking for something. Actually, you mentioned Dr. Lanier, and Dr. Lanier has my mentor. She's a very special person to me, and she is one that really helped bring different counselors together, because she mentored a lot of us. And I believe through her example, I hope, you know, that I have helped a few others. Yes. When I've done my supervisions. But she gave me this, and I want to share it.
Okay, that's fine.
All right, it says, wonderful counselor. And she said this, you know, she said this to different counselors, and I was one of the ones that she gave one to. It says, may you always find your identity and purpose in God, the wonderful counselor. How blessed we are to have been granted such a magnificent portion of his identity. More so, what an immeasurable opportunity to share that gift with the world and those in need of direction, healing, deliverance, affirming, exhorting, etc. So go forth and continue to be the special you that has been fearfully and wonderfully made by God, and the instrument that Saint Francis of Assisi prayed about in this excerpt. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. And so Dr. Lanier sent this out, and she sent it to counselors. But imagine, you know, what an experience with a counselor could look like.
Yes.
Because that's our hope for everybody we encounter. First, you got to make the move to get in the room, and then sit through that process. And that process can be wonderful.
Yes.
It can be a beautiful thing, because, you know, my bishop always teaches us, Bishop Rosie S. O'Neill, she teaches us, along with Pastor Trev, we were not meant to do life alone.
Right.
We weren't meant to.
Right.
So.
And that means a lot, because I hear so many in the young generation that say, I don't need nobody. But, you know, that's to understand, I need somebody. And I think about the song, I need you, you need me, we strong together.
<That's right.
laughs> So I don't know about that. I don't need nobody. I need somebody. I need some shoulder to lean on and cry on. You know, I'm thankful for my husband, but sometimes, you know, you just need that friend, girlfriend, or, you know, friend, associate or colleague. And I'm thankful, you know, for even being a part of the counseling group with you all, because it really has helped me, you know, realize that I'm not in this boat by myself, you know. So that is always a privilege, and I love that Dr. Lanier had given you, because it's nothing greater to be called a counselor like the wonderful counselor. Mm-hmm. That is a blessing to have and to hold. As always, you guys, share this podcast, like and subscribe. This is your girl, CL Suggs, with my sister, my friend, my mentor, Demetrius L. Cobb. Pray you all have an awesome day and weekend. Stay safe, peace, and love.